Chapter 27. He's gone. It's over, Anna said to herself, standing at the window, and in response to this thought, the impression of the darkness when the candle had flickered out and of her fearful nightmare merged into one, filling her heart with cold terror.
No, that cannot be, she cried, and crossing the room she rang the bell. She was so afraid now of being alone that without waiting for the servant to come in, she went out to meet him. "Inquire where the Count has gone," she said. The servant answered that the Count had gone to the stable.
"His Honour left word that if you cared to drive out, the carriage would be back immediately."
"Very good. Wait a minute. I'll write a note at once. Send Mikhail with the note to the stables. Hurry."
She sat down and wrote. "I was wrong. Come back home. I must explain. For God's sake, come. I'm afraid." She sealed it up and gave it to the servant. She was afraid of being left alone now. She followed the servant out of the room and went to the nursery.
"Why, this is wrong. This isn't he. Where are his blue eyes, his sweet, shy smile?"
was her first thought when she saw her chubby, rosy-cheeked little girl with her black curly hair instead of Seryozha, whom in the confusion of her mind she had expected to see in the nursery. The little girl sitting at the table was obstinately and violently battering it with a bottle stopper, and staring aimlessly at her mother with her two black currant-like eyes. Answering the English nurse that she was quite well, and that she was going to the country tomorrow, Anna sat down by the little girl and began spinning the stopper in front of her. But the child's loud, ringing laugh and the motion of her eyebrows recalled Vronsky so vividly that she got up hurriedly, restraining her sobs, and went away. Can it be all over?
No, it cannot be, she thought. He'll come back. But how can he explain that smile, that excitement, after he had been talking to her? Even if he doesn't explain, I'll believe. If I don't believe, there's only one thing left for me, and I can't.
She looked at her watch. 20 minutes had passed.
By now he has received the note and is coming back.
Not long. 10 minutes more. But what if he doesn't come?
No, that cannot be. He mustn't see me with tear-stained eyes. I'll go and wash. Yes, yes.
Did I do my hair or not? She asked herself. And she couldn't remember. She felt her head with her hand. Yes, my hair has been done. But when I did it, I can't in the least remember. She couldn't believe the evidence of her hand, and went up to the mirror to see whether she really had done her hair. She certainly had, but she couldn't remember when she had done it. "Who's that?" she thought, looking in the mirror at the swollen face with strangely glittering eyes that looked in a frightened way at her. "Why, it's me." She suddenly understood, and looking around she seemed all at once to feel his kisses on her, and twitched her shoulders, shuddering. Then she lifted her hand to her lips and kissed it.
"What is it?"
"Why, I'm going out of my mind." And she went into her bedroom, where Anushka was tidying the room.
"Anushka,"
she said, coming to a standstill before her, and she stared at the maid, not knowing what to say to her.
"You meant to go and see Darya Alexandrovna," said the maid, as though she understood.
"Darya Alexandrovna?" "Yes, I'll go. 15 minutes there, 15 minutes back. He's coming. He'll be here soon."
She took out her watch and looked at it. But how could he go away leaving me in such a state? How can he live without making up with me? She went to the window and began looking into the street. Judging by the time, he should be back now. But her calculations might be wrong, and she began once more to recall when he had started and to count the minutes. At the moment when she had moved away to the big clock to compare it with her watch, someone drove up. Glancing out of the window, she saw his carriage. But no one came upstairs, and voices could be heard below. It was the messenger who had come back in the carriage. She went down to him.
"We didn't catch the Count," The Count had driven off to Nizhegorodsky station.
What do you say?
What? She said to the rosy-faced, cheerful Mikhail as he handed her back her note.
Why then, he didn't receive it, she thought.
Go with this note to Countess Vronskaya's place, you know it, and bring an answer back immediately, she said to the messenger.
And I? What am I going to do? She thought.
Yes, I'm going to Dolly's, that's right, or else I shall go out of my mind.
Yes, and I can telegraph too.
And she wrote a telegram. I absolutely must talk to you. Come at once.
After sending off the telegram, she went to dress. When she was dressed, and in her hat, she glanced again into the eyes of the plump, comfortable-looking Anushka. There was unmistakable sympathy in those good-natured little grey eyes.
"Anushka, dear, what am I to do?" said Anna, sobbing, and sinking helplessly into a chair.
"Why upset yourself so, Anna Arkadyevna? Why, there's nothing unusual. Go out, it'll cheer you up," said the maid.
"Yes, I'm going," said Anna, rousing herself and getting up. "And if there's a telegram while I'm away, send it on to Darya Alexandrovna's. But no, I shall be back myself. Yes, I mustn't think. I must do something, drive somewhere,
and most of all get out of this house," she said, feeling with terror the strange turmoil going on in her own heart, and she made haste to go out and get into the carriage.
"Where to?" asked Pyotr before getting onto the box.
"To Zhamenka, the Oblonskys."
Chapter 28. The weather was bright. A fine rain had been falling all morning, but it had lately cleared up. The iron roofs, the flagstones of the pavement, the cobbled roadway, the wheels and leather, the brass and the metalwork of the carriages, all glistened brightly in the May sunshine. It was 3 o'clock, and the very liveliest time in the streets. As she sat in a corner of the comfortable carriage that hardly swayed on its supple springs while the greys trotted swiftly, in the midst of the unceasing rattle of wheels and the changing impressions in the pure air, Anna ran over the events of the last days, and she saw her position quite differently from how it had seemed at home. Now the thought of death seemed no longer so frightening and so clear to her, and death itself no longer seemed so inevitable. Now she blamed herself for the humiliation to which she had lowered herself. "I entreat him to forgive me. I've given in to him. I've confessed myself at fault. What for? Can't I live without him?" And leaving unanswered the question how she was going to live without him, she began reading the signs on the shops. "Office and warehouse, dental surgeon. Yes, I'll tell Dolly all about it. She doesn't like Vronsky. I shall be sick and ashamed, but I'll tell her. She loves me, and I'll follow her advice. I won't give in to him. I won't let him train me as he pleases. Bakery Filipov. They say they send their pastry to Petersburg. The Moscow water is so good for it. Ah, the springs at Mutishchi, and the pancakes." And she remembered how, long, long ago, when she was a girl of 17, she had gone with her aunt to Troitsa. Riding, too. Was that really me with red hands? How much that seemed to me then splendid and out of reach has become worthless, while what I had then has gone out of my reach forever. Could I ever have believed then that I could come to such humiliation? How conceited and self-satisfied he will be when he gets my note. But I'll show him. How horrid that paint smells. Why is it they're always painting and building? "Mode et robe," she read. A man bowed to her. It was Anushka's husband. "Our parasites." She remembered how Vronsky had said that. "Our? Why our?" "What's so awful is that one can't tear up the past by its roots. One can't tear it out. One can hide one's memory of it. And I'll hide it." And then she thought of her past with Alexei Alexandrovich, of how she had blotted the memory of it out of her life. "Dolly will think I'm leaving my second husband, and so I certainly must be in the wrong.
As if I cared to be right.
I can't help it, she said, and she wanted to cry. But at once she started wondering what those two girls could be smiling about. Love, most likely. They don't know how dreary it is, how degrading. The boulevard and the children. Three boys running, playing at horses. Seryozha. And I'm losing everything and not getting him back. Yes, I'm losing everything if he doesn't return. Perhaps he was late for the train and has come back by now.
Longing for humiliation again, she said to herself.
No, I'll go to Dolly and say straight out to her, I'm unhappy. I deserve this. I'm to blame. But still I'm unhappy. Help me.
These horses, this carriage, how loathsome I am to myself in this carriage. All his.
But I won't see them again. Thinking over the words in which she would tell Dolly, and mentally working her heart up to great bitterness, Anna went upstairs.
Is there anyone with her? She asked in the hall. Katerina Alexandrovna Levina, answered the footman.
Kitty. Kitty, whom Vronsky was in love with, thought Anna.
The girl he thinks of with love. He's sorry he didn't marry her. But me he thinks of with hatred, and is sorry he had anything to do with me.
The sisters were having a consultation about nursing when Anna called. Dolly went down alone to see the visitor who had interrupted their conversation.
"Well, so you've not gone away yet. I meant to come to you," she said. "I had a letter from Stiva today."
"We had a telegram, too," answered Anna, looking round for Kitty.
"He writes that he can't make out quite what Alexei Alexandrovitch wants, but he won't go away without a decisive answer."
"I thought you had someone with you. Can I see the letter?"
"Yes, Kitty," said Dolly, embarrassed. "She stayed in the nursery. She's been very ill."
"So I heard. May I see the letter?"
"I'll get it at once. But he doesn't refuse. On the contrary, Stiva has hopes," said Dolly, stopping in the doorway.
"I haven't. And indeed I don't wish it," said Anna. "What's this? Does Kitty consider it degrading to meet me?" thought Anna when she was alone. "Perhaps she's right, too. But it's not for her, the girl who was in love with Vronsky. It's not for her to show me that, even if it is true. I know that in my position I can't be received by any decent woman. I knew that from the first moment I sacrificed everything for him. And this is my reward. Oh, how I hate him! And what did I come here for? I'm worse here, more miserable." She heard from the next room the sisters' voices in consultation. "And what am I going to say to Dolly now? Amuse Kitty by the sight of my wretchedness? Submit to her patronizing? No. And besides, Dolly wouldn't understand. And it would be no good my telling her. It would only be interesting to see Kitty, to show her how I despise everyone and everything. Now nothing matters to me now." Dolly came in with a letter. Anna read it, and handed it back in silence.
"I knew all that," she said, "and it doesn't interest me in the least."
"Oh, why so?"
"On the contrary, I have hopes," said Dolly, looking inquisitively at Anna.
She had never seen her in such a strangely irritable condition.
"When are you going away?" she asked.
Anna, half closing her eyes, looked straight before her and didn't answer.
"Why does Kitty shrink from me?"
she said, looking at the door and flushing red.
"Oh, what nonsense! She's nursing, and things aren't going right with her, and I've been advising her." "She's delighted!"
"She'll be here in a minute," said Dolly, awkwardly, not clever at lying.
"Yes, here she is."
Hearing that Anna had called, Kitty had wanted not to appear, but Dolly persuaded her. Gathering her courage, Kitty went in, walked up to her, blushing, and shook hands.
"I'm so glad to see you," she said with a trembling voice.
Kitty had been thrown into confusion by the inward conflict between her antagonism to this bad woman and her desire to be nice to her. But as soon as she saw Anna's lovely and attractive face, all feeling of antagonism disappeared,
I shouldn't have been surprised if you'd not cared to meet me. I'm used to everything. You've been ill?
Yes, you are changed, said Anna.
Kitty felt that Anna was looking at her with hostile eyes. She ascribed this hostility to the awkward position in which Anna, who had once patronized her, must feel toward her now, and she felt sorry for her. They talked of Kitty's illness, of the baby, of Stiva, but it was obvious that nothing interested Anna.
I came to say goodbye to you, she said, getting up.
Oh, when are you going?
But again, not answering, Anna turned to Kitty.
Yes, I'm very glad to have seen you, she said with a smile. I've heard so much of you from everyone, even from your husband.
He came to see me, and I liked him very much, she said, unmistakably with malicious intent. Where is he?
He's gone back to the country, said Kitty, blushing.
Remember me to him. Be sure you do.
I'll be sure to, Kitty said naively, looking compassionately into her eyes. So, goodbye, Dolly.
And kissing Dolly and shaking hands with Kitty, Anna went out hurriedly.
She's just the same and just as charming. She's very lovely, said Kitty when she was alone with her sister. But there's something pitiful about her, terribly pitiful.
Yes, there's something unusual about her today, said Dolly.
When I went with her into the hall, I thought she was almost crying.
Chapter 29 Anna got into the carriage again in an even worse frame of mind than when she had set out from home. To her previous tortures was added now that sense of mortification and of being an outcast which she had felt so distinctly on meeting Kitty.
Where to? Home? Asked Pyotr.
Yes, home, she said,
not even thinking now where she was going.
How they looked at me is something dreadful, incomprehensible, and curious.
What can he be telling the other with such warmth? She thought, staring at two men who walked by.
Can one ever tell anyone what one is feeling?
I meant to tell Dolly, and it's a good thing I didn't tell her. How pleased she would have been at my misery. She would have concealed it, but her chief feeling would have been delight at my being punished for the happiness she envied me for. Kitty! She would have been even more pleased. How I can see through her. She knows I was more than usually nice to her husband, and she's jealous and hates me. And she despises me. In her eyes, I'm an immoral woman. If I were an immoral woman, I could have made her husband fall in love with me. If I'd cared to. And indeed, I did care to. There's someone who's pleased with himself, she thought, as she saw a fat, rubicund gentleman coming toward her.
He took her for an acquaintance, and lifted his glossy hat above his bald, glossy head, and then perceived his mistake.
He thought he knew me. Well, he knows me as well as anyone in the world knows me.
I don't know myself.
I know my appetites, as the French say. Those two boys want some of that filthy ice cream. That they do know for certain, she thought,
looking at two boys stopping an ice cream vendor, who took a tub off his head and began wiping his perspiring face with a towel.
We all want what is sweet and nice. If not sweets, then dirty ice cream. And Kitty's the same. If not Vronsky, then Levin. And she envies me and hates me. And we all hate each other. Aye, Kitty? Kitty, me. Yes, that's the truth. Tiutkin, coiffeur. Je me fais coiffer par Tiutkin. I'll tell him that when he comes, she thought, and smiled. But the same instant she remembered that she had no one now to tell anything amusing to. There's nothing amusing, nothing mirthful, really. It's all hateful. They're ringing the bells for Vespers, and how carefully that merchant crosses himself. As if he were afraid of dropping something. Why these churches and this ringing and this humbug? Simply to conceal that we all hate each other, like these cab drivers who are abusing each other so angrily. Yashvin says he wants to strip me of my shirt, and I him of his.
Yes, that's the truth.
She was plunged in these thoughts, which so engrossed her that she ceased thinking of her own position, when the carriage drew up at the steps of her house. It was only when she saw the porter running out to meet her that she remembered she had sent the note and the telegram.
"Is there an answer?" she inquired.
"I'll see this minute," answered the porter,
and glancing into his room, he took out and gave her the thin square envelope of a telegram.
"I can't come before 10 o'clock, Vronsky," she read.
"And hasn't the messenger come back?"
"No,"
answered the porter. "Then, since it's so, I know what I must do," she said. And feeling a vague fury and craving for revenge rising up within her, she ran upstairs. "I'll go to him myself. Before going away forever, I'll tell him all. Never have I hated anyone as I hate that man," she thought. Seeing his hat on the rack, she shuddered with aversion. She didn't consider that his telegram was an answer to her telegram, and that he had not yet received her note. She pictured him to herself as talking calmly to his mother and Princess Sorokina, and rejoicing at her sufferings.
"Yes, I must go quickly," she said,
not knowing yet where she was going. She longed to get away as quickly as possible from the feelings she had gone through in that awful house. The servants, the walls, the things in that house, all aroused revulsion and hatred in her, and lay like a weight upon her.
"Yes, I must go to the railway station, and if he's not there, then go there and catch him."
Anna looked at the timetable in the newspapers. An evening train went at 8:02.
"Yes, I shall be in time."
She gave orders for the other horses to be harnessed, and packed in a valise the things needed for a few days. She knew she would never come back here again. Among the plans that came into her head, she vaguely determined that after what would happen at the station, or at the Countess's house, she would go as far as the first town on the Nizhegorodsky railway and stop there. Dinner was on the table. She went up, but the smell of the bread and cheese was enough to make her feel that all food was disgusting. She ordered the carriage and went out. The house threw a shadow now right across the street, but it was a bright evening and still warm in the sunshine. Annushka, who came down with her things, and Pyotr, who put the things in the carriage, and the coachman, evidently out of humour, were all hateful to her, and irritated her by their words and actions.
"I don't want you, Pyotr."
"But how about the ticket?"
"Well, as you like. It doesn't matter," she said crossly.
Pyotr jumped on the box, and putting his arms akimbo, he told the coachman to drive to the station. Chapter 30
"There again. It's that girl.
Again I understand it all," Anna said to herself as soon as the carriage had started, and swaying lightly rumbled over the tiny cobbles of the road, and again one impression followed rapidly upon another.
"Yes. What was the last thing I thought of so clearly?"
She tried to recall it.
"Tiutkin coiffeur? No, not that. Yes, of what Yashvin says. The struggle for existence and hatred is the one thing that holds men together."
"No, it's a useless journey you're making," she said,
mentally addressing a party in a coach and four, evidently making an excursion into the country. "And the dog you're taking with you will be no help to you. You can't get away from yourselves." Turning her eyes in the direction Pyotr had turned to look, she saw a workman almost dead drunk, with hanging head, being led away by a policeman.
"Ah, he's found a quicker way," she thought.
"Count Vronsky and I didn't find that happiness either, though we expected so much from it." And now, for the first time, Anna turned that glaring light in which she was seeing everything on to her relations with him, which she had hitherto avoided thinking about.
"What was it he sought in me? Not love so much as the satisfaction of vanity."
She remembered his words, the expression of his face, which recalled an abject setter dog in the early days of their love affair. And everything now confirmed this.
Yes, there was the triumph of success in him.
Of course there was love too, but the chief element was the pride of success. He boasted of me.
Now that's over. There's nothing to be proud of. Nothing to be proud of. Only to be ashamed of.
He's taken from me all he could, and now I'm no use to him. He's weary of me, and is trying not to be dishonourable in his behaviour toward me. He let that out yesterday. He wants divorce and marriage so as to burn his ships. He loves me, but how? The zest is gone, as the English say.
That fellow wants everyone to admire him, and is very much pleased with himself, she thought, looking at a red-cheeked clerk riding on a hired horse.
Yes, there's not the same flavour about me for him now. If I go away from him, at the bottom of his heart, he'll be glad. This was not mere supposition. She saw it distinctly in the piercing light which revealed to her now the meaning of life and human relations.
My love keeps growing more passionate and selfish, while his is dying. That's why we're drifting apart, she went on, musing. And there's nothing I can do.
He's everything to me, and I want him more and more to give himself up to me entirely. And he wants more and more to get away from me. We were irresistibly drawn together up to the time of our love, and now we've been irresistibly drifting apart. And there's no altering that. He tells me I'm insanely jealous, but it's not true. I'm not jealous, but I'm unsatisfied. But...
She opened her lips and shifted her place in the carriage in the excitement aroused by the thoughts which suddenly struck her.
If I could be anything but a mistress, passionately caring for nothing but his caresses. But I can't, and I don't care to be anything else.
And by that desire I arouse aversion in him, and he arouses fury in me, and it cannot be different.
Don't I know that he wouldn't deceive me, that he has no schemes about Princess Sorokina, that he's not in love with Kitty, that he won't desert me? I know all that, but it makes it no easier for me. If, without loving me, from duty he'll be good and kind to me. Without what I want, that's 1,000 times worse than unkindness. That's hell. And that's just how it is. For a long while now he hasn't loved me. And where love ends, hate begins.
I don't know these streets at all. Hills, it seems, and still houses. And houses. And in the houses... always people and people. How many of them, no end and all hating each other.
Well, let me try and think what I want to make me happy.
Well, suppose I am divorced,
and Alexei Alexandrovitch lets me have Seryozha, and I marry Vronsky.
Thinking of Alexei Alexandrovitch, she at once pictured him with extraordinary vividness as though he were alive before her. With his mild, lifeless, dull eyes, the blue veins in his white hands, his intonations and the cracking of his knuckles, and remembering the feeling that had existed between them, and that was also called love, she shuddered with loathing.
Well, I'm divorced and become Vronsky's wife.
Well, will Kitty cease looking at me as she looked at me today?
No.
And will Seryozha stop asking and wondering about my two husbands? And is there any new feeling I can awaken between Vronsky and me? Is there possible, if not happiness, some sort of ease from misery?
No, no, she answered now without the slightest hesitation. Impossible. We are drawn apart by life, and I make his unhappiness and he mine. And there's no changing him or me. Every attempt has been made, but the screw has lost its thread.
Oh! A beggar woman with a baby. She thinks I'm sorry for her.
Aren't we all flung into the world only to hate each other, and so to torture ourselves and each other? Schoolboys coming, laughing. Seryozha, she thought. I thought, too, that I loved him and used to be touched by my own tenderness. But I've lived without him. I gave him up for another love. And didn't regret the exchange as long as that other love satisfied me. And with loathing she thought of what she meant by that other love, and the clearness with which she saw life now, her own and everyone's, afforded her pleasure. It's so with me, and Pyotr, and the coachman Fyodor, and that merchant. and all the people living along the Volga, where those advertisements invite one to go, and everywhere, and always, she thought, when she'd driven up to the low building of the Nizhegorodsky station, and the porters ran to meet her.
A ticket to Obirilovka, said Pyotr.
She'd utterly forgotten where and why she was going, and only by a great effort did she understand the question.
Yes, she said, handing him her purse, and taking a little red bag on her arm, she got out of the carriage.
Making her way through the crowd to the first-class waiting-room, she gradually recollected all the details of her situation, and the plans between which she was hesitating. And again at the old sore spots, hope and then despair poisoned the wounds of her tortured, fearfully throbbing heart. As she sat on the star-shaped sofa waiting for the train, she gazed with aversion at the people coming and going. They were all hateful to her, and thought how she would arrive at the station, would write him a note, and what she would write to him, and how he was at this moment complaining to his mother of his position, not understanding her sufferings, and how she would go into the room, and what she would say to him. Then she thought that life might still be happy, and how miserably she loved and hated him, and how fearfully her heart was beating.
Chapter 31
A bell rang. Some young men, ugly and impudent, and at the same time mindful of the impression they were making, hurried by. Pyotr, too, crossed the room in his livery and gaiters, with his dull animal face, and came up to her to take her to the train. Some noisy men were quiet as she passed them on the platform, and one whispered something about her to another, something vile, no doubt. She climbed up the high step of the railway carriage, and sat down in an empty compartment on a dirty seat that had been white. Her bag bounced on the springy seat, and then was still. With a foolish smile, Pyotr raised his hat, with its coloured band, at the window, in token of farewell. An impudent conductor slammed the door and the latch. A grotesque-looking lady, wearing a bustle, Anna mentally undressed the woman, and was appalled at her hideousness, and a little girl, laughing affectedly, ran down the platform.
"Katerina Andreevna, she's got everything, ma tante," cried the girl.
"Even the child's hideous and affected," thought Anna. To avoid seeing anyone, she got up quickly and seated herself at the opposite window of the empty carriage. A deformed peasant, covered with dirt, in a cap from which his tousled hair stuck out, passed by that window, stooping down to the carriage wheels. "There's something familiar about that hideous peasant," thought Anna. And remembering her dream, she moved away to the opposite door, shaking with terror. The conductor opened the door and let in a man and his wife.
"Do you wish to get out?"
Anna made no answer. The conductor and the two fellow passengers didn't notice her panic-stricken face under her veil. She went back to her corner and sat down. The couple seated themselves on the opposite side and intently, but surreptitiously, scrutinized her clothes. Both husband and wife seemed repulsive to Anna. The husband asked her if she would allow him to smoke, obviously not with a view to smoking, but to getting into conversation with her. Receiving her assent, he said to his wife in French something about caring less to smoke than to talk. They made inane and affected remarks to one another, entirely for her benefit. Anna saw clearly that they were sick of each other and hated each other, and no one could have helped hating such miserable monstrosities. A second bell sounded, and was followed by the moving of luggage, noise, shouting, and laughter. It was so clear to Anna that there was nothing for anyone to be glad of, that this laughter irritated her agonizingly, and she would have liked to stop up her ears not to hear it. At last the third bell rang. There was a whistle and a hiss of steam, and the coupling chains jerked, and the man in her carriage crossed himself. "It would be interesting to ask him what meaning he attaches to that," thought Anna, looking angrily at him. She looked past the lady out of the window at the people who seemed whirling by as they ran beside the train or stood on the platform. The train, jerking at regular intervals at the joints of the rails, rolled by the platform, past a stone wall, a signal box, past other trains, the wheels moving more smoothly and evenly, making a slight ringing sound. The window was lighted up by the bright evening sun,
and a slight breeze played against the blind. Anna forgot her fellow passengers, and to the light swaying of the train she started thinking again as she inhaled the fresh air. Where did I leave off? On the thought that I couldn't conceive a position in which life would not be misery, that we're all created to be miserable, and that we all know it, and all invent means of deceiving each other. And when one sees the truth, what is one to do?
That's what reason is given man for, to escape from what worries him, said the lady in French, lisping affectedly and obviously pleased with her phrase.
The words seemed an answer to Anna's thoughts.
To escape from what worries him, repeated Anna.
And glancing at the red-cheeked husband and the thin wife, she saw that the sickly wife considered herself misunderstood, and the husband deceived her and encouraged her in that idea of herself. Directing her searchlight on them, Anna seemed to see their entire history and all the crannies of their souls, but there was nothing interesting in them, and she pursued her thoughts.
Yes, I'm very much worried.
And that's what reason was given me for, to escape.
So then one must escape.
Why not put out the light when there's nothing more to look at, when it's sickening to look at it? But how?
Why did the conductor run along the footboard? Why are they all shrieking, those young men in that train?
Why are they talking? Why are they laughing? It's all falsehood, all lying, all humbug, all evil. When the train came into the station, Anna got out into the crowd of passengers, and moving apart from them as if they were lepers, she stood on the platform, trying to think what she had come here for and what she meant to do. Everything that had seemed to her possible before was now so difficult to consider, especially in this noisy crowd of hideous people who wouldn't leave her alone. At one moment porters ran up to her, proffering their services, then young men clacking their heels on the planks of the platform and talking loudly stared at her. Then people meeting her dodged past on the wrong side. Remembering that she had meant to go on if there was no answer, she stopped a porter and asked if her coachman was here with a note from Count Vronsky.
Count Vronsky? Or someone from there was just here to meet Princess Sorokina and her daughter. And what's the coachman like?
Just as she was talking to the porter, the coachman Mikhail, red-faced and cheerful in his smart blue coat and with a watch chain, evidently proud of having so successfully performed his commission, came up to her and gave her a letter. She broke it open, and her heart ached even before she read it.
"I'm very sorry your note didn't reach me. I'll be home at 10,
Vronsky had written in a careless hand.
"Yes, that's what I expected,"
she said to herself with a malicious smile.
"Very good. You can go home, then," she said, softly addressing Mikhail.
She spoke softly because the rapidity of her heart's beating hindered her breathing. "No, I won't let you make me miserable," she thought menacingly, addressing not him, not herself, but the power that made her suffer. And she walked along the platform past the station buildings. Two servant girls walking along the platform turned their heads, staring at her and making some remarks about her dress.
"Real,"
they said of the lace she was wearing. The young men wouldn't leave her in peace. Again they passed by, peering into her face, and with a laugh shouting something in an unnatural voice. The station master, coming up, asked her whether she was going by train. A boy selling kvass never took his eyes off her.
"My God, where am I to go?" she thought,
going further and further along the platform. At the end she stopped. Some ladies and children, who had come to meet a gentleman in spectacles, paused in their loud laughter and talking, and stared at her as she reached them. She quickened her pace and walked away from them to the edge of the platform. A goods train was coming in. The platform began to sway, and she imagined that she was in the train again. And all at once she thought of the man crushed by the train the day she had first met Vronsky, and she knew what she had to do. With a rapid, light step, she went down the steps that led from the water tank to the rails, and stopped close to the approaching train. She looked at the lower part of the trucks, at the bolts and chains, and the tall iron wheels of the first truck slowly moving up, and trying to measure the midpoint between the front and back wheels, and the very moment when that point would be opposite her. "There," she said to herself, looking in the shadow of the truck at the mixture of sand and coal dust which covered the ties. "There, in the very middle, and I shall punish him and escape from everyone and from myself." She wanted to fall halfway between the wheels of the front car, which was drawing level with her, but the red bag which she began to take from her arm delayed her, and she was too late. The car had passed. She had to wait for the next. A feeling such as she had known when about to take the first plunge in bathing came upon her, and she crossed herself. That familiar gesture brought back into her soul a whole series of memories of her childhood and girlhood, and suddenly the darkness that had covered everything for her was torn apart, and life rose up before her for an instant with all its bright past joys. But she didn't take her eyes from the wheels of the second car, and exactly at the moment when the midpoint between the wheels drew level with her, she threw away the red bag, and drawing her head back into her shoulders, fell on her hands under the car, and with a light movement, as though she would rise immediately, dropped on her knees. And at the instant she was terror-stricken at what she was doing. "Where am I? What am I doing? What for?" She tried to get up, to throw herself back, but something huge and merciless struck her on the head and dragged her down on her back. "Lord, forgive me everything," she said, feeling it impossible to struggle. A peasant, muttering something, was working above the iron, and the light of the candle by which she had read the book, filled with troubles, falsehoods, sorrows, and evil, flared up more brightly than ever before, lighted up for her all that had been shrouded in darkness, flickered, began to grow dim, and was quenched for ever.